Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
As we prepare to switch from analog to digital, we bring you four stories of change. First, we learn about a small section of Oakland that's voicing its support and admiration for a man who murdered four police officers.
Kelly?
Yes.
How are you? You're on. Thanks for calling in on Street Soldiers.
The officers, I feel that they deserve what they got.
Why?
How can you even say something like
why?
That?
But do you want to hear from the street now? See, I know this game. I know that what it's going to do. We're going to be hurt by it.
What does that have to do with this? What does that have to do with this tragedy?
How did he get to that point? How did he get to that point?
He shouldn't have done that. He shouldn't have pulled a gun and shot four people.
And one day, Lavelle Mixon went from being anonymous to infamous. An ex-felon and rape suspect, so we're now calling him a modern-day Nat Turner.
I don't know Lavelle Mixon, so I don't think that it's really an issue of him being a hero so much, because we don't know the character of the man, but at the same time, what he did was heroic.
On March 21st, two Oakland police officers pulled Mixon over on a routine traffic stop. He gave them his license and then opened fire.
My eyes lowered and they were on the ground. And had they fallen like they do on TV, then maybe it wouldn't have been so horrific for me, but they didn't fall just flat, they crumpled. And for me to see two figures, authority figures with uniforms on the ground was something pretty horrific for me that I wish I'd never seen.
Mixon fled the scene and ran 50 yards to his sister's apartment. During a standoff, he used an AK-47 to kill two more officers before being shot to death himself.
I think we were all like paralyzed in a sense, just trying to hopefully that it would turn out for the best, even though it turned out very tragically on both sides.
The shooting has left many people asking why. Mixon had recently left prison, was looking for a job, and hoping to reconcile with his estranged wife. Some family members speculate that when the officers pulled him over, Mixon did whatever it took to stay out of prison.
I see that was somebody that has some situations going on and decided that day to just make a statement of how he was feeling.
Young black men don't even have a future. Lavelle Mixon's life was over before that day when he was stopped by those officers.
And I think a lot of the population in America, or I say even the population of the Bay Area, doesn't know what black males in particular go through with the police.
J.R. Valerie is a reporter for KPFA Radio and the SF Bayview, an African-American newspaper. Most recently, he wrote an article about Mixon, headlined, Police 2, Oakland Residents 4.
I titled it that so that it could reflect the fact that we see him as an occupying army. I mean, there's no difference from the checkpoints in East Oakland and the checkpoints in Iraq.
While Caroline Mixon is still grieving for her cousin, she maintains her support for the police.
Oh, the officers are out to get, you know, every young African-American man that's driving down the street. That's not true. The police is not the enemy. The police officers are here to serve and to protect.
And while that is usually the case, the Oakland Police Department was hit with several scandals in the last year. From officers falsifying warrants to a bar police officer killing an unarmed and restrained Oscar Grant. Each of these incidents has led some in the African-American community to feel the police are targeting them.
They may have been great fathers and great friends to their neighbors in the communities where they live, but when they come to Oakland and they put on that uniform and that gun, they have a different relationship with us in the black community.
Patrick Gonzalez was one of the officers wounded by Mixon. He killed two young black males and paralyzed another in a two-year period. For some, that information validates Mixon's actions.
We forced to look at them in their face when they drive by in their police cars, and they above the law, basically, in our community. So when Lavelle Mixon settles the score, I mean, we kind of feel like, how does it feel when the rabbit has the gun?
Bakri Olatunje is the president of Uhuru House, an organization that encourages police resistance. They held a vigil and rally for Mixon. His mother and wife attended.
Not only was it an act of defiance that Lavelle had made, but it was an act of defiance for the community to come together to talk about resistance.
Lavelle is a hero!
That was a good dude!
Lavelle is a hero!
It was a lot of people who normally don't come to our meetings on Sundays, who normally don't participate in political life, but they came out to say that this brother represented resistance and protecting the community.
60 residents joined the vigil, a small number compared to the hundreds who attended the vigil for the police a day earlier.
I believe that that the people that do support a person that was a rapist and a killer is very small. And I know that most of the people in this community, Oakland, do support the police department.
You have the community willing to rebel against anything. And it's like, well, why would you spring a rebellion in the community when there is no reason? You can't bring a mixed message if you're trying to bring healing to a community. It has to be, let's start focusing on how to recover from this.
Concerned citizens are attending weekly town hall meetings where residents and police officers can work toward change. One group has organized an Oakland chapter of Cop Watch.
We are nonviolent observers and also seek to de-escalate situations. We can have accountability. We don't have to wait for internal affairs to get around to it. We don't have to wait for the police department to investigate itself. This kind of polarization does happen, you know, police versus people, which shouldn't be happening, except that, you know, there are suspicions on both sides.
On a recent Sunday, a crowd of about 100 people walked from Vacaville to Oakland to honor the fallen officers.
I don't know as far as relationship building, how that's going to work. It takes effort on both parts. I think no matter what happens, I think there's going to be a portion of the of people who will never like the police, no matter what we say.
A month after the shooting, things are slowly returning to normal. Only a few empty tea candles remain at the memorial for Mixon. A billboard of the fallen officers has now been replaced with a cell phone ad. But after a turbulent year that has rocked both the police department and the community, for many people in Oakland, normal isn't good enough.
People in Oakland is fed up with the bull that's been dished down from government and the police. Oakland is going to be one of the sparks to hopefully change what's happening in this nation.
Now the story of an Iranian American who wants to improve understanding between his two cultures in an unlikely way, by skiing in the Olympics.
Americans, Canadians, Europeans, they see me wearing the jacket from Iran, and right away people are like, what are they like over there? Do they hate Americans? It's that typical stereotype that people think exists.
Namju Hashemi is on an ambitious mission. He wants to ski for Iran in the 2010 Winter Olympics. This giant slalom race is his last chance of the winter season to better his international standing.
He wants to be the ambassador of peace and reconciling the differences between Iran and U.S.
Hashemi is seeking funding from his neighbors in Los Angeles, home to an estimated 500,000 Persians. Families began immigrating to the city in 1979, the year of the Islamic Revolution and the hostile takeover of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. 3 decades of animosity followed. However, this year, Persians like Hashemi see a reason to look forward to a new beginning.
There are those who insist that we be defined by our differences. But let us remember the words that were written by the poet Sa'di so many years ago. The children of Adam are limbs to each other, having been created of one essence.
We have a new U.S. administration with President Obama, who's been sending the right signals. Pick 1,000 people out of the streets of Iran and 1,000 people out of the street in the U.S. Everybody wants to be best of friends. There's a bunch of misunderstanding and misinformation, whether it be the media on each side.
So are you the person from Iran?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, well, welcome.
I hate to start things off like this, but we've had...
At races in the States and in Europe, Hashemi is a rare sight. He says he sees each race as an opportunity to bridge the gap of misunderstanding about Iran.
A dual national, not some, you know, guy who doesn't know how to ski. I go, wow, you're actually Iranian background, and that's what you're like. And for a lot of people, maybe it's their first time meeting somebody from Iran.
Competitors are especially surprised that, like Westerners, Iranians can hit the slopes in their own country.
Comparable to the Rockies, and light powder. It was amazing skiing.
Hashemi learned to ski in Iran's Elbors Mountains at the age of 10, just 1 year after the revolution. That's when his family left Canada for Tehran. His Iranian parents wanted him to be immersed in Persian culture and to learn to speak Farsi.
When I went into this full Farsi school, I had a very, very heavy accent. I got a little, teased about it.
Under Islamic rule, skiing was considered a decadent sport, and Iran would not send skiers to the Olympics again until 1998. But fortunately for Hashemi, resorts remained open.
I was in love with the sport right from day one.
He returned to Toronto for high school and raced competitively until college. As an adult, he moved to L.A. for his master's in business and took a job in real estate, skiing only occasionally on vacation.
21.
Then, last fall, just a few years shy of his 40th birthday, Hashemi told his friends, his wife, and his 3-year-old daughter the time had come for him to pursue a dream.
25, Hashemi.
Yep.
That's it.
It's a bullet.
Down, work those legs, keep moving. Down.
He said to me, I want to ski. I said, ski, what do you mean skiing? And he goes, I'm going to ski. So you go ahead and ski. He goes, no, I'm going to ski for Iran. I said, does Iran have a skiing team?
His campaign came together quickly. He launched a website. He received free equipment from ski companies. And finally, Iran's Ski Federation gave him permission to race under the country's international code. Soon, he was racing in Europe.
There's not such an age as 38 or 40 or 50 or whatever, you know. The difference is the ability to recover. You don't recover as quick as you do when you're 16.
But age is just one of the strikes against Hashemi. His international rank is 376 points. To qualify for the Olympics, it needs to be below 140 points. In effect, in a sport where a fraction of a second wins a race, Hashemi must shave 40 seconds off his time.
You just can't grab it by being the only person racing in the United States.
Huya Payan is a former member of the Iranian national ski team who now lives in Los Angeles.
2003, the year I was leaving the team, I think it was the start of good improvement in the ski team.
In fact, this year, Iran participated in a World Cup race for the first time since the revolution. And in March, Iran announced that for the first time in history, it will send a female skier to the Winter Olympics. All team members are ranked well below 140 points and are at least 9 years younger than Hashemi.
Someone cannot just go from any country and say I'm representing just because there's lack of communication.
Still, Hashemi had reason to hope. In February, the president of the Iranian Ski Federation invited him to an international competition.
The benefit of that race, they have a much smaller field. And if you can bring in a couple of good European good racers with low FIS points, it can bring your point systems down.
So Hashemi booked a flight to Iran and began training for the race. But at the last minute, the Ski Federation pulled him from the competition. Suddenly, he no longer qualified. His points were too high.
Some people do not want me to succeed or try to make it as difficult as they can for me. Unfortunately, Iran, there's a lot of politics involved.
The Persian singer, he has a famous a piece in his song. He says, when I go to Iran, they call me the outsider. When I'm in the U.S., they call me the terrorist. So where is my home?
Dave, to timing, course is clear. We can send the next racer.
On course, Namju Hashemi, wearing bib 125, racing for Iran.
But I sure thought I held back a bit. I could have pushed myself a little bit more, but, you know, since a lot of people didn't make it, I just want to make sure I made it.
97.
Hashemi's 83rd place finish did not improve his world standing. This summer, he hopes to have more chances to race in South America. Yet that too seems beyond reach. He says he will need thousands of dollars to forge ahead, and so far he's only raised $60 in donations, less than the price of a lift ticket.
It is definitely a big goal if he can achieve it.
It's really hard, even for those guys who are like ultra supermans, but it's not impossible.
Hashemi may have an outside chance at the Olympics, but that's not the only reason he continues his quest.
In the end, if what I'm doing helps bring, you know, both sides one step closer, it makes it worthwhile.
Advances in medicine mean that Americans are living longer.
but they're also living sicker. And for many senior citizens, the burdens of old age are more than they can bear.
I just remember kind of being so stunned, and then I just yelled right out into the phone something like, I just can't believe anyone would do that. I know from the coroner's report, it seemed that he had gone to the kitchen and had some orange juice, and then he went into his home office, which was the spare bedroom. And so he had a shotgun there, and he somehow aimed it towards his head, from what I hear. And it's really violent, that kind of death.
When Grishin Gokhi's father, Joseph, killed himself, he was 69 years old. His death was a personal tragedy for the Gokhi family, but it also illustrates a disturbing fact. Senior citizens are more likely to kill themselves than any other age group. Elderly white men commit suicide at the highest rates, and more often than not, they use guns.
Suicide is really about how a person is experiencing shame, how a person is experiencing loss.
Patrick Arbour runs the Center for Elderly Suicide Prevention in San Francisco. Since 1976, his organization has helped more than 30,000 seniors dealing with depression, loneliness, and thoughts of suicide.
One of the things we have to really thoughtfully consider in this country is how we die. 80% of the people who die in this country do so in acute care settings. So it makes death look a little scary, you know, because now I'm hooked to machines, I'm in ICU. I don't know what to do with that. And so I might just decide that I would rather kill myself.
Anxiety about death affects even those who are relatively healthy. In fact, the majority of seniors who commit suicide, like Grishin's father, have no terminal illness.
He was very afraid, but he would never admit that. The idea of becoming old and limited was really, I think, not acceptable to him.
I got it. 96 is not a normal age. People don't live that long generally.
Milton Cavalli is my grandfather. At 96, he and my grandmother increasingly rely on their caregiver, Kathy, for things that they could once do on their own.
I can't function like I used to, and that bothers me. I'd like to be able to get out and walk without any help and pick up something and carry it somewhere. I can't do that anymore.
For as long as I can remember, my papa was big and strong and healthy. But in the last 2 years, he has been in and out of the hospital 7 times. He says he fears dying like his mother did, slowly, in a rest home.
She would lay on her back and look at the ceiling. I said, what are we keeping her alive for? She has no life. She doesn't know what's going on. I don't want to go like that. When it comes to the suffering time, just cut it off, you know? I don't want to suffer. When I go, I want to go fast.
A good death is often defined as I die in my sleep. So I go to bed and I die and I don't wake up again. And that's not necessarily the way it is, but I think it fuels anxiety to think there's a good death and I might not have it.
I don't want to die because I've still got a daughter and a couple of grandchildren I want to see mature more. They have enjoyment with my old cars. They're brought to 2 car clubs. They go to their meetings. And people remark about them, gee, I call you, you're never home. So we're on the go all the time, you know. We're going here, there, everywhere.
How are you?
Good to see you.
It's like this everywhere he goes. My papa has hundreds of friends, and they're a big part of what keeps him going. Studies show that older people with strong social ties live longer, healthier, happier lives. Isolation can lead to depression, and all too often, suicide.
Is it the embarrassment or the pain more that keeps you from wanting to go outdoors?
To help isolated seniors, Arbor's organization runs a crisis and support hotline called the Friendship Line. The center also offers counseling for grieving friends and family.
We tend to put the focus on the person who dies, in this case, commits suicide. And we tend as a society, because we're a grief-denying society, we tend to just think that at the funeral, things will be resolved, and that's going to be the hardest part. And then, you know, they're just going to go on with their lives.
In the wake of her father's suicide 22 years ago, Goki struggled with grief and anger. Then she met Arbor, who helped her transform her grief into art. First photography, and now dance. Recently, she started a dance group for seniors, which meets every Friday at the local senior center.
The expectations about aging that you have to stop moving are wrong.
Everything we do there promotes the complete opposite of depression, isolation, and despair.
For a lot of people who are in their 70s, 80s, 90s, the time is now to reflect, you know, to really ponder what this life experience has been. What's the meaning in your life?
I want to stick around a while yet. I wake up in the morning, I'm still alive. Hooray! We're living on a day-to-day basis, you know. She does that all the time.
Some old forms of technology are so beautiful and evocative that even long after they've become outdated, they find devotees to keep them alive. Old steam engines have found a fan base in young artists and engineers.
This shouldn't be happening. This traction engine, a steam-powered ancestor of the tractor, dates back to 1917. But here it is, chugging down the streets of Oakland on its first drive in about half a century. Inside a warehouse in West Oakland, the formerly booming industrial heart of the city, volunteers are bringing back to life the machines that launched the Industrial Revolution, old-fashioned steam engines.
We're trying to grab a hold of the knowledge, you know, get the stories. You know, I want to know where this engine came from, not just that it's cool, I want to know its backstory. I'm the third owner of Hortense, that 40-horse case. I know everything about it since the day it was bought. The history is what really makes it all pop for me.
Zachary Rickstella is the founder of Kinetic Steamworks, an organization merging engineering prowess with kinetic art. Their steam-powered works have taken them everywhere, from 4th of July parades to Burning Man and Coachella. Zachary and his friends like to dress the part, but their love of steam goes much deeper than style.
You know, we're not using our equipment for its intended purpose. At the same time, respecting the equipment by restoring it to factory specs and, if modifying anything, making it so that it's reversible.
Those who run Kinetic Steamworks day in and day out see the engines as works of art in and of themselves.
You know, people just like to stare at this stuff. I mean, I'm quite happy to stare at it.
Stephen Rademacher is a plumber by training. He sees restoring the engines as an homage to the history of industrialization.
This is the experience you get seeing the way that they did it before modern machining techniques, welding. You know, the engine's made without a weld. And that's, to me, it's shocking. That's magic.
Their latest toy, Pappy, is Kinetic Steamworks' second case traction engine, as well as their oldest, born in 1917.
Based on the forensics of our restoration, I would say that engine hasn't run in 50 years.
Pappy first went to work in a sawmill. After that, its life is a mystery up until the mid-80s.
And just yesterday, I found out that the engine had spent some time in South Dakota at a truck stop on display.
From there, it went into a museum in Arizona. But when the owner died, it was sold to a wealthy businessman who entrusted its restoration to Kinetic Steamworks. As part of the deal, Zachary and his team get to use Pappy for events. But before they can embark on any new adventures, they have to test Pappy out. After 2 years of restoration work, including recasting many of its parts, today is Pappy's big debut. Volunteers stayed up all night perfecting a fan used to test Pappy's load.
I have to keep running it harder to keep the belt straight. Stop for a second. You do have a bearing smoking problem.
Good call. Yeah. Turn bearer.
Yep. This was the telling test. The engine was sluggish, and the Babbitt needs to be worked on. That's what we found out. It's going to involve sort of tearing a lot of it all apart again to get to.
But it wasn't all work and no play. The volunteers got to take Pappy for a joyride.
I drove it around the block simply as a release. It was just fun. Try to give everybody a turn, you know? You're steering now. You're firing now. Just the thrill of driving around a 15-ton steam engine in West Oakland.
If all goes well, Pappy will hit the road again this summer, going from the hip Maker's Fair to old-timey threshing events.
Ours is an industry in transition. Looking ahead, who knows what's next? But news will never be obsolete. Thanks for watching.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.